people were saying it was clocking like minus 12 in places between the hours of kind of 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. It was brutal. There was a section of which was quite nice in some respects, just flattish road, tarmac road for like 40 kilometers, and this was for me the coldest part of the race. It was quite mundane, quite boring, but because you're moving faster, because you're on the road, you get the wind chill and the tarmac as well. It's actually much colder being on the tarmac than it is off-road, like noticeably so. That was the only time where I was just like, all right, I just need to just keep moving. Like another couple of hours of this, the sun's going to start coming out. But that was, you know, super cold. I remember going past someone and they were just on the side, like, I'm not sure what to do. Like, I'm absolutely freezing. Like, I can't really stop and get in my sleeping bag here. Like, there's nothing here. And I was just like, you literally just have to put on everything you've got and just move forward.
And we're back, this time interviewing Charlie Bell, an absolutely exceptional guy. As we'll hear, Charlie is doing these incredible races when he's got time, in getting his training in around his day-to-day work, sometimes waking up at 4:30 in the morning to get these sessions done so that he's in reasonable shape to then crank out triple Ironmans. We're talking 11.5 kilometer swim, 540 kilometer bike, 126 kilometer run. Just one of a number of mind-bending races that he's been involved in. We're going to be getting into the mind games that he plays in getting the training done during the event itself. The training and how he goes about structuring that, the kind of training that he gets into, as well as really practical advice on how you survive one of these events. But before we get into it, I really need your help. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support this channel, please head over to our YouTube, head over to the Apple Podcasts or the Spotify, drop us a follow. I never used to do this with any other content that I consumed until I started this and realized that just how important it is. It really helps share the message behind this podcast to many other people. Let's get into it. Charlie, so good to get you on the episode this week. Thanks a lot for coming by. How's it going?
All good. Super, super excited. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. I was sent your name on very good authority. The line was, I think you should have a chat with Charlie Bell. He's just come off this this very long bike race through the Atlas Mountains, and he's also had a bit of a time with injuries as well. So I thought, perfect. This sounds really interesting. Had no idea what the Atlas Mountain race was. Looked into it. I was like, this is a pretty serious race. You know, 1,300 kilometers, fully self-supported. You've got over 20,000 meters of elevation gain. Superb. We're going to get some great material here and find out what this man is up to. So I started doing my research and came across your 2022, so last year, your Trans Balkan race, very much of a similar, almost identical actually, 1,300 kilometers again, but this time it's 27,000 meters of elevation gain.
Yeah.
And then I took it back a bit further and saw back in 2018, you cranked out a triple Ironman, which I didn't even know they existed. You know, double Ironmans are a thing of fairy tales. And then 2016 was a double Ironman Lithuania. I was thinking, what the hell is going on? Yeah, otherwise, this man has either lost a series of very large bets or there's something going on inside his head that we need to find out exactly what it is.
Lost the plot, possibly.
So before we get into the juicy details of how the hell you've done the things that you have, I think this idea of identity in sport is a really interesting one, and speaking, kind of picking up from a point that Tom Jolly made on the last episode that we recorded together, and this idea that especially as he hit injury, you're not allowed to do the things you love, And it's not just the mental benefit that you get from doing sport, because it is such an integral part of your identity. You know, he identifies ultra marathon runner, and suddenly that is taken away from you. He found it very difficult. So in your case, how would you go about describing your relationship with sport, and what part of your identity it plays there?
Cool, what a question to kick it off. So I suppose over the years, I mean, it's not something you wake up one day and suddenly you sort of need to exercise loads, but over the years, from a relatively young age, I've kind of developed this, I suppose, increasing reliance on wanting to exercise, wanting to push myself, which nowadays kind of manifests itself in, if I am exercising on a regular basis, I'm training towards something, I kind of feel like my day-to-day outside of that is in a much better place. So like everything I do, whether it be work or just like interactions with people, I think my wife will probably say I'm in a much better mood if I am if I'm having that outlet on a sort of daily basis. It has a big impact. And if it's sort of taken away from you for whatever reason, you can definitely get a little bit cranky, and you know, the rest of what you do, whether it be work and things, there's something missing in your day to day, and yeah, that's it. I think you mentioned sort of about injury. Touch wood, I've not experienced anything sort of huge which has taken me out for prolonged periods of time. I mean, last year, literally a year ago, and the sort of closest thing, the most recent thing where, you know, that ability to exercise, that ability to train and do endurance things has been taken away from me. I sort of had a prolonged case of back-to-back flus, which lasted for a period of about 4 or 5 months, where I was like not doing much else other than just eating, sleeping and working. And you know, mentally, when you don't know when there's going to be an end to that and you're going to be able to get back to normal, I found that, you know, particularly tough. But I'm also acutely aware that that is not nearly as bad as what some other people go through as far as injury and things. So that's probably my like biggest, most recent experience where I've, you know, had that taken away from me.
Mm. And so just to give people a bit of an idea of your background and your current situation at the moment, exercise is very much kind of on the side. You've in the 9-to-5 game and you are signing up to these competitions whenever you kind of got holiday. That's the current situation?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, so until two and a half years ago, I was in the British Army. So I suppose like part of the day to day with that, you know, you sometimes get exposure to like doing endurancy related things, and your day to day is a lot more active. So I suppose I started the kind of endurance journey whilst I was in the army. Like I did the triple Ironman whilst I was in, the double Ironman, a few kind of ultra marathons, single Ironmans. So it was a little more kind of flexible in that space, and like day to day you keep quite fit just as a result of being in the army. And then since leaving, I'm very much in the 9-to-5 game. I work in technology sales. I can like to some degree kind of control my diary a little bit. It's relatively flexible in that respect. It's remote. And I think since starting the 9-to-5, like all of this for me has become exponentially like more important to my sort of well-being, to make sure that I am regularly doing things, having things which I can focus on, you know, 6 months out. And just like day to day, like starting my day off with some form of kind of training, an outlet, yeah, it's definitely far more important.
Absolutely. And so before the army, I mean, you mentioned that when this really started kind of gathering pace was whilst you were in the army. Before that, did you have any kind of inkling that you might find yourself in these kind of situations?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this earlier. I mean, so my family is pretty active. Like, to give you an example, when I was sort of 12 years old, sort of holidays sometimes were cycling across Scotland with my mum type thing. When I was 16, I did cycled Land's End to John O'Groats on like a pretty heavy mountain bike in 10 days with a mate. Like no idea what we were doing, you know, just literally backpack on and using obviously old school maps back then, a little OS map, and just sort of went for it. So yeah, that all sort of came at a pretty young age, I suppose. But, you know, my sister Emily, she has kayaked the length of, she's kayaked Land's End, John O'Groats, supporting Sean Conway, who swam it. I don't know if you've heard of Sean, what a sort of adventurer. He does multiple pretty gnarly things. My other sister's about to do her first Ironman. You know, I suppose like that's got to be related to it. And whilst my mum, you know, is very active and definitely partly to blame, she also regularly now questions, you know, is that the last one now? Have you got you're done now, presumably. So yeah,
classic,
I think
online.
Yeah, exactly. Although it's entirely her fault, the whole thing. But yeah.
So do you think there's an element of sibling rivalry there? Is there much of an age gap between you and your sister?
Yeah, there's a little bit of an age gap. I wouldn't say rivalry in any respect, no. But we, yeah, like support each other. I think everyone's very interested when others are doing these sorts of things. But yeah.
Yeah. Out of interest, how did you go about kayaking Land's End to John O'Groats?
Yeah, so they had, I think they bought a, Sean bought this yacht which they lived on, like super basic, super cheap. So that was kind of the support vehicle. And then she would kayak actually like next to him all the way up, which it ended up taking sort of 2 months longer than they were expecting. And they were still going in the Highlands of Scotland in November, which is pretty brutal. so yeah, that was a pretty cool thing that they did. Yeah,
absolutely. So yeah, by the sounds of this, this is in the blood. There's no doubt about it. This wasn't suddenly you hit the army and people were doing some interesting things, so you thought, why not? I'll get involved too without really knowing what I'm signing up for. It sounds like you've got a pretty strong base from the outset there. And so coming into the army, would you say that kind of supercharged that ambition to was it to see what was possible? Was it my mates are doing this as well? How did you get into that?
Yeah, I think it's not necessarily something which I've done like because mates are doing it or anything like that. In fact, most of my mates are definitely not into this sort of thing. I suppose firstly, the adventure side of things, like seeing cool places. But I think the overarching thing, you know, if you take the Triple Ironman, which you're going around a 1 mile loop, for example, you're not seeing anything particularly cool. So that, you know, that definitely comes down to the pushing yourself, and seeing how far you can push yourself, type thing. I think more recently, and whilst I still do have a place for those kind of events where it is almost quite mundane and like mind numbing, it's a mental game. You know, the run for the Triple Ironman, it was like, I think just over a mile loop, and it was just on a hill. So you were constantly either going uphill or downhill and hammering your knees. And whilst, like, for me, that's a massive mental challenge, and it's just raw, like, how hard you can push yourself. There's not really much else to it. And the preparation and training you've put in beforehand. The things which I've done more recently, which I'm finding really appealing, so like the Transbalkan, the Atlas Mountain race, it's got that element clearly of having to push yourself really hard, and, you know, like 2 to 3 hours sleep a night for 5 days, and the rest of the time you're literally just moving forward. So that is clearly like ticking the pushing yourself box. But the other side of it is they take you to like incredible places, you know, super, super remote. The Atlas Mountain race, you know, you have sort of, I think almost a 200K stretch just through the mountains where there's just nothing. And the next thing you hit is like a tiny little mountain village, which has a tiny little shop, and they might sell some bottled water in there type thing. you got to hope they do. But yeah, so I think that's kind of the main two components. But as I say, there's definitely still a place. Whilst I've seen that, you know, like these races which can take you to amazing places, I haven't ruled out races which are a little more mundane in nature, and it's literally just you against your mind going around a circuit, you know, endlessly to see how far you can push yourself.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's interesting that you point out you've got on this one hand the bucket lists, kind of incredible adventure, but then also this mind-numbing, just bloody-minded, can I get it done element. And just kind of looking through your races and looking at the amount of people that take part in these, and then also looking at the finishing rate, these are events that aren't necessarily, not competitive is not the right word, but the challenge is finishing the damn thing. I mean, the last one, the Atlas race, the 200 riders, only 117 finished. Transbalkan race, again, less than 50% of people actually finished, of which you came, you know, 21st in the Atlas Mountain race, and Transbalkan, you came clocked to 14th place. Again, the Triple Ironman, you know, less than 50% of the people finished. So you're really going after these challenges where a huge element is just, can it be done? Was that kind of a deliberate choice at the outset? Were you looking at it from, I want to see how well I can do, or was it purely, can I do this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not like a 5K race where the likelihood is you're going to finish, and it's very much like you against the competition, who can get there faster. All of these races where there's so many variables, there's so much that can go wrong. And whilst there's like healthy competition between people, you also find yourself like feeding off of other people, like riding next to someone for 5 hours and chatting to them. You know, the competition is with your head.
Yeah.
It's making sure that you're in a position where you can keep moving forward. So that is like, you've got the resupply down. You haven't like not stopped when you should have done to fill up with water and found yourself like dehydrated. You've made sure you've stocked up on food. You're keeping your bike in working order. You're actually like not hammering it down hills as quickly as you can, because there's more risk of you falling off and again not finishing it, and, you know, more risk of like having a mechanical as a result. It's dealing with mechanicals when you get them and kind of like keeping your head, you know. It's really easy when you're in the middle of the mountains or whatever, you're 3 days in, you've had, you know, 5-6 hours sleep over 3 days, and you're like hallucinating, and you get like your fifth puncture, and you're like, your mind races immediately to, oh gosh, this is it, you know, I'm not going to finish this, I'm going to have to bail. And just another thing on bailing on these races, you're up in the mountains. So if you want to bail, you got to get out of the mountains and find your own way back, which I think probably stops some people from quitting. But yeah, all of that is like managing your own, managing your kind of yourself. You know, it's not really about other people. Like I think you know, right up at the pointy end of these races, which I'm not in, you know, there's probably more competition as far as like actually looking at other people. But I think even some of these guys, you know, who are winning these races, they're not necessarily looking at the tracker and seeing how far away other people are. They're just racing their own race. And it's, yeah, remaining positive. It's really like primitive in many respects. It's eat, sleep, although sleep not so much, and just like keep moving forward. And I think that's sometimes part of the appeal for these races, like day-to-day life. Like we get dragged down by so many different sort of distractions and things and trivial things, which are just not important. And this like strips it all back, and it's like, there's not much more to it than just keep moving forward as efficiently as you can. And by doing that, yeah, you need to eat the right amount and you need to sleep as much as you need to sleep. And like, that's it. And you keep doing that through amazing places sometimes. Until you finish.
Fantastic. And that's on, before we really dig into to your, I mean, unbelievable bike packing races. Because on the flip side, you know, you've mentioned you're out in the middle of nowhere, you've got to get out there by yourself. So it's a bit more difficult to sack it in because they're fully unsupported. However, when you're going around a 1 mile loop, and you've got your mates there on the sideline supporting you, and there's a nice little chair, and there's a load of food. You take a seat, and it's, well, what's the worst? You know, if I didn't get up again in Krakow, you know, what's the worst that could happen there? Tell us, how did this triple Ironman, which completely captivates my imagination, how did this come about? How did that?
I mean, it all starts with a pretty natural kind of progression, in that when I was like 20, I did an Ironman. Well, it was the Outlaw in Nottingham. So it's like not the Ironman brand, but Ironman distance. I did that. I think 20 is quite young to be doing that kind of distance. And I was at university. I wasn't living a very, like, you know, sort of healthy athlete lifestyle by any means, and I struggled through that a lot and finished. And around that time I was doing some like fairly short sort of ultra marathony type events and things like that as well, but that was kind of the biggest thing I'd done sort of around that age. And then, like specifically for the journey to a triple Ironman, someone had mentioned to me, I think about 6 months after I'd done it, a double Ironman, and they said to me, would you be up for doing one? And I was like, mate, you're mental. I found that absolutely hideous. I'm definitely not doing that. And I did, so that was 2010. I didn't do another Ironman until 2015, when I did Barcelona. And that was a much more kind of like a better experience. You know, I did a fairly decent amount of training and did it, finished it. And I got to the end of that, and I fairly quickly after, I was like, the thought of that double Ironman, which that person had mentioned kind of 4 years ago, crept into my head. And I was like, I'm just going to have a bit of a Google and just see, you know, firstly, does this thing even exist, or do you have to sort of put it on yourself? And so I stumbled across the double Ironman Lithuania, which was pretty niche. And I just signed up a year later, did the double Ironman. Trained reasonably for it, probably less than I trained for the single Ironman. And again, that was probably kind of like the lowest I've been as far as like or close to not finishing one. My parents and sister flew out with me. It was a pretty cool event in that for the small town we were doing it in, it was a huge deal for them. They had this kind of procession, you know, they closed the town, they had this procession. I was carrying the Union Jack. the mayor spoke, you know, it was all on their TV. It was pretty amusing. And you know, it was some niche event where like there were 25 people doing it. But I did that. It was super hot. It was probably, I think it hit sort of 35 degrees. And I just hadn't got nutrition right at all. And I got probably halfway into the bike. And I just started, just everything started coming up and was just vomiting. And I knew, like, I obviously had enough knowledge to know that you just have to keep eating. That is key to these events. And I just couldn't eat anything, and it was probably about 5-6 hours where even if I had a sort of sip of water, I was hurling. And I just remember being like, there was kind of this support tent at the, you know, where the kind of main, each lap comes around and goes past these tents, and you had your own little one. And I just, there's a photo of me just curled up in a ball lying on the ground, not even that far into the event, and like my mum and dad and sister are standing over me probably thinking, what on earth are you putting yourself through this for? And the race organizer came over, and I remember he said, like, you will have ups and downs on this event, you're obviously, you know, at a low place, all you need to do is just keep moving forward. And I think like that was probably just about enough for me to jump back on the bike and keep moving forward. And it's again, but part of the appeal of some of these events, you think you're at rock bottom, or you are at rock bottom, and you're like, you know, I'm going to pull the plug. And literally an hour later, you can suddenly be flying and like, you know, back in, and you know, you can suddenly eat again, and like, I don't know, the sun's come up and you're just feeling good. And that's kind of what happened. So I finished it, you know, not in a record breaking time by any means. I remember during the run, one of the sort of odd experiences of the race, there was some, it's about 5 a.m. and some drunk guy had come out of a nightclub and decided that he was going to run next to me, which wasn't hugely welcome. And unfortunately, he spoke perfect English, obviously, which I pretended I didn't speak any English. And he followed me for like quite a good distance, probably like 4 or 5 miles. And yeah, that was one of my sort of lasting memories. I was very glad when he decided to go home and go to bed. But yeah, so that was that. And then, so that was 2016. So this is a really long-winded answer to your question.
Cool, loving it.
And then that was 2016. And then end of 2017, I hadn't thought about a triple at all before this time. And then end of 2017, I just decided I wanted to. I was back on the bike a lot. I was doing a lot of cycling, probably, well, the most I'd kind of ever done, like a regular amount. And I thought, well, I've done single, I've done a double. I've seen that you can do triple Ironmans. I mean, you can do any number. But I kind of wanted to do an event where it was as continuous as possible. So i.e. not a stage race where you're breaking in between, like something where you can almost stay awake for the entirety of the event and you're at your very limit. Because I think if you go longer than a triple, I mean, there are some animals who probably don't do any sleep, but you're looking at having to schedule like a decent chunk of sleep. So anyway, I signed up to this for 2018. I think there were 12 other people entered. It's called Enduro Man, and it's just this bizarre weekend where they put on multiple different events, from the running loop. You can just enter, I'll just run for 72 hours and see how many laps of this I can do, to, you know, single marathons, single Ironmans, double Ironmans, long swims, literally anything you want. And yeah, there's not many entrants. As I say, 12 for the triple Ironman. And I was aware, especially with just how the double Ironman had gone, that, you know, it's a fairly big undertaking, this, and I'm going to have to put in the hours. So I was doing, yeah, a lot more. You know, I was up at, like, occasionally 4:30 before work, putting in the hours and trying to get in two sessions a lot of days. And, yeah, and I felt good during, I mean, sorry, that's not quite the right word. I had my ups and downs during the event. But overall, you know, I think I managed it a lot better than I previously had done on other events. And whilst I was in, like, yeah, as you would expect, like, a serious pain by the end, it was like a positive experience. It was cool.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said both there for the triple and the double. And it was kind of the logical progression. It was, well, I've done one, I may as well do two. Well, I've done two, I may as well done three. And it's not like you're jumping into this with, you know, like the first one where you've got no really, you don't know what the deal is. Go on then, let's give this a crack and see if it can be done. You are fully aware of the pain that awaits.
Yeah.
And so knowing that, what was it about it that called you? Nevertheless,
I think it just goes back to this just desire to see how far I could go. And I didn't sign up to this thinking I'm definitely going to be able to finish a triple Ironman. And I, like, much like doing the Atlas Mountain race or Transbalkan, I think I like the idea of, there is an element of, you know, there, it's not certain that I'm going to complete these. In fact, there's, like, quite high odds that you won't. And just putting yourself out there, which obviously makes you apprehensive as well, because it's like you put in all this training and you know, and I obviously do have a normal job and, like, a normal life as well. So, you put in all this training and you might not finish it. But that's also part of the appeal, just to see whether I can do it, how hard I can push myself, how well I've prepared for it. And going through these, like, you know, you're going to go through lows. You know, no matter how hard you train, you're going to go through a moment during that event where you question, why am I doing this? And being able to sort of untangle, you know, those negative thoughts during the race and get your head, like, back on straight and focused on the end goal. Which ultimately is just, at the time, the process of doing that is just literally put one foot in front of the other, just keep moving forward, I find appealing. And I guess, you know, part of it is that feeling once you finish, obviously, like, once you've gone through those ups and downs. But I wouldn't do any of this if I just enjoyed the feeling at the finish. I think people can sometimes think that, you know, you push yourself really hard because when you cross the finish line, it's amazing. Like, there are elements, like, during the race, like, I do enjoy the process of getting there. Like, I do enjoy, you know, the highs, the, you know, at any of these events, like, particularly when the sun starts coming up, when you've been going through, like, a long night. In Morocco, it was 13 hours of darkness, and, you know, it gets to, you know, and it's hitting minus 10 degrees, you get to seven, I think the sun was coming up, it's 7:30, you start seeing the sun coming up, and it's just like this overwhelming kind of, oh, this is amazing, this is epic. And you see this insane landscape, and you might have some music playing in your ear, and you're just like, you know, just those like snapshot moments which are just make you feel awesome. It makes you feel good.
Amazing. I'm picturing it now from what you're saying, and it sounds absolutely unbelievable. I mean, it must have been an incredible experience.
And, yeah.
Before we get into those bike races, unbelievable expeditions themselves, you got very into your bike after your triathlon. At what point did you really, you've done a bit of bike racing, with the army as well. At what point were you really started to take it seriously and started getting competitive there, and decide that perhaps you could leave the swimming and the running to one side and focus more on your cycling?
I think during the training for Triple Ironman, the vast majority of it was done on the bike. You may find the same with the Ironmans you do, but I feel like the gains you can make on the bike often translate quite nicely onto the run, like building that aerobic engine, and it doesn't like batter your muscles, you know, pounding the pavement. Sure. So I was really into cycling when I like took on the Triple Ironman, like more than I was to running, and definitely more than swimming. So yeah, after that, I kind of just, it wasn't necessarily like the competitive nature. I just enjoyed cycling a lot more, you know, in London, like before work, there's this whole kind of niche community that wakes up at really early hours in the morning, like 365 days a year, and meet up in some bizarre place in London, and I don't know, go and do like hill reps, you know, before anyone's even gotten out of bed in the dark, in the freezing cold, and then go and have a coffee, and then go home, and that's when everyone else wakes up. And you know, so there's like, I think, lots of different reasons why I've gotten into that, and that's definitely one of them. It's that whole kind of thing of just, I suppose, being out early in the morning and getting the endorphins in. But yeah, I did a little bit of crit racing, by no means anything much. Did that in 2018, 2019, and haven't actually done any since then. But I'm, this year, it is on the to-do list. Post Atlas Mountain race, once I can finally walk normally again, I will start building up the training for that. But yeah, and then I suppose that's what slowly took me into, again, I like dot around a lot, you know, so I was in cycling for a bit, and then 2020 I'd signed up for the Bigfoot Ultra, which is near Seattle, and it goes through one of their national parks, and it was a 200-mile, so I, just for clarity, I haven't done this because COVID kind of drove a train through it. But I had signed up for that in 2020. It was like a 200-mile continuous ultra through a national park, which is maybe still on the bucket list one day, for one day, but we'll see. So yeah, I've definitely like flicked around a lot. And then, you know, since then, when that was cancelled, I was back on the bike, signed up to Atlas Mountain Race, which was meant to be in beginning of 2021, but, you know, kept getting pushed because of COVID, signed up to Transbalkan in between, and then have finally done that. But yeah, at the moment, I'm very much just kind of cycling as my main thing.
You mentioned part of this was, there is that kind of community of people who wake up at silly o'clock and get out there and smash some hill reps. Was that something that very much kind of appealed to you, doing it with other people, or was this a solo effort on your part?
Definitely like motivation from, you know, other people. You know, definitely not solo effort. Like, I enjoy, you know, cycling's great because you can like chat to people as you're going, and you can like meet up with people easily. And doing like 5-6 hour rides solo is not the most exciting thing. I mean, I definitely do it, and the sort of people that I cycle with when I'm sort of you know, building up to these events probably get slightly bored of me putting on the WhatsApp group in like December, you know, January, December, when everyone else is just chilling out, like, do you want to do a like ridiculously long ride? And they're like, no, Charlie, no, we're good. So that sort of community kind of aspect of it is definitely cool, and keeps me motivated and like keeps me interested in it. And it's a whole other dimension of it, you know. It's, you've got the like going into the Atlas Mountains and things like that, but then, you know, I go to like Regent's Park on a week morning and enjoy that as well and have a coffee afterwards. So yeah.
Okay, so there's a bit of a mix there. And did your fitness come about through this kind of love of getting stuck in with other people and therefore doing a lot of cycling as a result? Or did you always kind of set out with a very clear idea of what training had to be done on certain days, perhaps working with a coach? How did you go about structuring that?
I have previously, I've never worked like with a coach. I've like thought about, you know, thought about doing that, definitely. But I think one of the things which kind of slightly has put me off in the past is it can start to make training quite unfun. I have sort of fairly basic principles which I try and stick to. So if it's, you know, building up for a long endurance event, I mean, you have to do a lot of zone two, like base building, and you've got to get some decent volume in as well. Of course, like, you've then got to add in a little bit of high-end stuff, some threshold stuff on top of that, but you need to be, you know, focusing on that base, sort of 80-20 type training. I know Tom Jolly was a big advocate of that, and yeah, so that's kind of, I try and just stick to some fairly basic principles, listen to my body. Like, if I, you know, haven't done, if I'm feeling a little bit sluggish, then have more rest days, you know, really quite basic stuff. And then adding in a tiny bit of strength training on top of that, which again is one of my things to do. To do more of this year, but for me, as soon as I start scheduling in, like Monday you have to do this, Tuesday you have to do this, I think I stop kind of enjoying it. You know, if there's kind of a fast ride, if people are going out on a fast ride and I'm feeling fairly fresh, then I'll just go for it and not think too much about sort of training per se. I think if you can, like, clearly you're going to get to a higher level if you know, follow some kind of structure in the way you do things, but I think for me it's, you know, more about enjoyment than it is trying to get to the very, very peak. And I also think there's something to say for, like, if you do want to do these events, you've got to make sure you're enjoying the training, because it's like a lot of time, you know, you're dedicating to something. And if you're purely just viewing it as like, I don't know, I've got this in my program, I've got to get this done, sometimes that can be good motivation. But yeah, who knows? But I, you know, I'm open to trying it as well. So maybe for the next one, I'll give it a go.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix. And I think what you said about enjoyment is absolutely critical, because otherwise why are you doing it? You know, you're not going to be consistent. If there's ever going to be the opportunity to make an excuse, it's going to be made if you're not really enjoying it. Having said that, certainly at the level, certainly the distances that you are covering, I don't know about, cycling in England in December outside sounds pretty grim, frankly. And so certainly when I was preparing for slightly longer stuff, it would be rather than 5 hours outside, it'd be 5 hours on the turbo, which is pretty difficult to enjoy. But nevertheless, as you say, it's, you've really got to get those hours in. And so it's kind of finding that balance between the two.
100%. And if my alarm is set for 5:30 in the morning in December, the alarm doesn't go off and I like jump out of bed like pumped to go outside in the freezing weather, definitely. And I also use the turbo trainer, which is pretty mind-numbing, and if it's pouring with rain outside but I've got to get some volume in, like 2 hours on the turbo trainer is pretty dull, which I obviously try and avoid doing as much as I can. There's, as you say, there's a balance, and then that's part of the kind of enjoyment. It's like holding yourself to account. Yeah. And when you don't want to do it, your alarm goes off and you negotiate in your head and you're like, I could just do this like in 2 days' time. I think I'm feeling a bit tired. You're not actually feeling tired. It's just your alarm's gone off and you're having those initial thoughts, which most people do. But if you can not press snooze and like not turn your alarm off and like get up and commit to it, it's the hard choice of the time, but like it pays dividends. Like your day will be better as a result. And I don't just mean like in isolation of like the training you're doing, the event you're working towards. I mean like everything else will feel better as a result of you doing that. I don't want to sit here and claim, I don't think anyone finds it easy every single time to like commit to a training session and do it. So yeah, trying to enjoy it as much as one can, but there are times when you've got to like push through and find the motivation for sure. I don't know if you've read the, do you know who I mean by David Goggins?
I do indeed.
Which I find some of his, when he's talking, like it's fairly amusing and it's pretty out there stuff.
Absolute savage.
And it's a little bit far fetched, some of it, saying you should like carry on running in an ultra marathon when you've broken both your legs or whatever. It's like you could just
call
go
home.
I'd probably tap out at that stage. But he does like some of the points he has, about just holding yourself to account. Like I think he calls it the accountability mirror, and like looking in the mirror and giving yourself like the honest truth of where you're at, like what you're trying to do. Don't let your head play games with you. Like be completely honest to yourself, and you will crave the duvet when it's cold and the alarm goes off and you need to get out of bed and you need to go and do something. But overcoming that is what makes you kind of progress. And
no, 100%. Moving it forwards to what your training looked like for these epic bike packing races, what sort of program were you looking at on kind of a weekly basis there? How did you go about structuring that? Because these are a quite a different kettle of fish. So we're not talking about 180k's worth of tarmac. We're talking about serious elevation, hardly any tarmac at all. The majority of it is gravel. So very long climbs. You're carrying all your kit. So the kind of level of fitness that you require there is a bit of a different form from saying holding a certain amount of watts over much nicer terrain in that sense.
Yeah, definitely. I've done as you know, two of these big events now, and I'd say on the build up to both of them, it's been far from ideal. So I've slightly adapted my training on both of them. For the Transbalkan, that was in June last year, and the kind of period of illness which I had started in the October prior, which I spoke, you know, before about, where, you know, nothing serious, but just back-to-back flus, which kind of put me out for about four or five months. That started kind of back in October before that event. So I only really started getting back on the bike in kind of February time, and the event was in June. So ideally I would have built up kind of a huge base. And when I came back to the bike, I was like, the one thing I cannot do is overcook it and go back to feeling like that. So I didn't do nearly as much as I had wanted to. I think as a regular, at that point when I came back on, I just took it really easy. So very little kind of high intensity stuff, not huge volumes, and was just making sure that I was making some progress to building back kind of endurance, some kind of endurance fitness. And that was probably, you know, initially, we're talking like 200-250k a week kind of thing. And some of that was a little more high intensity, some of it was less so. The important bit for me to make sure that I was also getting in and like confident that I was feeling good enough to do was then some like sort of longer rides. So so things like 300 and so like King Alfred's Way I did in one go, so that was like 330 kilometers or whatever it is off-road. So you know, doing that in one go. I went up before Atlas Mountains, went up to the Peak District in end of November for 2 days, and just did two like monster days, you know, proper hiker bike, carrying kit. Yeah. And just, you know, getting used to that. And a lot of it is just making sure your equipment works, like making sure everything fits on the bike properly, your like charging process, because you charge off of it. Well, some people use a big battery pack which lasts the whole thing, but I've got like a dynamo hub, so you plug in the charging, you're making sure like your admin with all of that is working and good to go. So it's more than just kind of the fitness element of it. But yeah, I think making sure that you're getting in those big rides, genuinely for pre-Atlas Mountain race, again, all of December I was off the bike. There's a bit of a recurring theme here with like getting the flu in winter. So that was really far from ideal, because that was, you know, this time 2 months before the event, and that was literally like 4 weeks off the bike. So then I came back in January onto the bike again, super cautious. And like the longest ride I did was probably 100k flat on tarmac, so like not ideal prep by any means.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And just like a lot of flat stuff, but again, like, so none of those are kind of your perfect training thing. I think ideally what you want with these events, well, ideally what you want is if you're coming into it for the first time, you really want to be building up some like pretty long-term endurance for, you know, because to be on the move for kind of 5 days without having a kind of 5, 6, 7 days without having a proper, you know, rest of more than like 3 hours, it's more than kind of, I don't know, like a 12-week endurance program. You've probably done some endurance training in another sport prior to coming into this, which you've built up, I suppose, over like a couple of years, and then your main focus, you just want like lots of base training initially, and then adding in some kind of like longer intervals, like 5-minute intervals, 20-minute intervals, 15-minute intervals, kind of at threshold and above. And I think kind of a six month kind of build program of that. But I'd say another thing is, you know, reading up on a lot of the top guys, like your sort of James Hayden, who kind of win a lot of these events, they don't come into these events like peaking like you would for a short event. So, sorry, when I say short event, like a one day event. So that you're not coming in like they're not coming in like really, really lean, you know, with no body fat, like good to go, because you kind of can't, because your body will just, if you've got 0% body fat at the start of that, then you're gonna struggle day three. So yeah, there's definitely like a little more cautious approach, always having something left in the tank, and that goes through like from training right through to the actual event, never like completely emptying yourself, to making sure you've always got like a little bit of reserve to give. But the guys at the front of these, you know, the very front of these races are phenomenal athletes, and they, you know, they'll do, I'm 2 weeks post the race and my body's still like pretty broken. These guys are back on the bike within a few days and they're starting to build up for their next event. You know, they'll do five of these types of events a year. It's pretty mad.
Mate, don't put yourself down too much. You came 21st. I mean, unbelievable achievement.
not at the pointy end.
So these events are a different order of magnitude, not just because of the terrain that you're going over, the distances you're covering. I mean, what were we talking about? A couple of hundred kilometers every day, with unreal elevation and terrain that you've got to cover there. But also, as you alluded to earlier, the admin side of things. Unsupported means completely unsupported. So anything that breaks, you've got to have spares. When it comes to, you know, things like sleeping, food, how do you go about arranging and organizing that?
Yeah, so just a thing on unsupported, and every race has their own slightly different rules, but typically for these events, unsupported means you can buy food from anything which is commercially available to any other rider. You can buy anything which is commercially available to any other rider. So you couldn't have your mates like on some really remote part sitting there, you know, with like a water replen. I think you'd probably struggle to find mates willing to do that. But so you can buy stuff. You're not carrying food from the very beginning, and of course water as well. The choice of what you can eat in these sort of parts of the world, like in the mountains in Morocco, is pretty limited. And I feel like I lived off these kind of packaged cakes pretty much solidly for 5 days, with the odd omelette and tagine thrown in there, and, you know, and Pro Plus caffeine tablets, and that was pretty much it. So not hugely healthy stuff, but again, when, like I mentioned, like always having something, a little reserve in the tank, making sure that if you're going past a village, because you're not sure, you know, when shops are going to be open, if you hit your if there's been like a 150k section with no resupply, and then you hit that next resupply in the middle of the night, it's probably not going to be open. So you've always got to be like thinking, where's my next stop, where am I going to get my next stuff from? But importantly, if you're riding out of a village and you're thinking to yourself, I'm not quite sure I've got enough here, you know, it's pretty important to be conservative, turn back around, go to the shop, like top up again. So not taking risks like that is super important. Transbulk and I ran out of water for doing exactly that for kind of 4 or so hours, and it was so hot. and I was just, I had sort of, you know, a quarter of a bottle, and I, the sort of realization that I'd kind of messed up started becoming more and more apparent. So I was just sort of like, just sort of wetting my lips with it every, like, every 20 minutes and not, you know, giving myself any more, because there was just a super slow bit of terrain to get over. And yeah, not getting yourself in those situations by just being a little bit conservative is really important. The other kind of admin things, which will come as no surprise on a long ride like this, is the contact point with the saddle, which again, I learned a lot of lessons after the first one, learned them the hard way. I didn't bring much chamois cream. I didn't sort of do the correct amount of admin during the race.
Yeah.
And I was on a climb at about 3 a.m. and a guy comes past me, another, I just saw a headlamp coming towards me. And I was actually on the side of the road with my shorts down, trying to take a photo so I could see what was actually happening down there. And he was like, "You all right, mate?" And I was like, "It's not great."
He didn't and, offer to take the photo for you.
No, he didn't. No, he moved on pretty swiftly. Yeah, that's like a really minor problem, which you can get away with, you know, 1-2 days. If you don't keep on top of it, by day three, you're in a lot of pain. Day five, you're sort of crying. That was my kind of nemesis for on the Trans-Balkan. That and punctures, silly amounts of punctures, and probably overall just being on a gravel bike when I should have been on a mountain bike, which probably contributed to all of that. Like your admin, so like cleaning down there when you can, applying like chamois cream, and just making sure you're in good nick. There was a story from the Atlas Mountains, and I don't know the exact details, but there was a guy who went to sleep and he hung his shorts up on his bivvy like to air out, and he woke up and his shorts were gone. And you don't bring spare shorts on these events. So
which is one pair of shorts the whole way.
Wow. Yeah, which is why you've really got to keep on top of the admin. And he woke up and was like, "Oh dear." And he put on his waterproof trousers, which, you know, it's like those of like bin bag waterproof trousers, and apparently wrapped his down jacket around his bum to kind of like give a bit of padding. And I think he had to have, he came into the finish and literally had to go straight into hospital and get operated on. Because he had pushed it so hard. I think I would have tapped out long before that. But yeah, so it just, like, small problems can become big ones if you don't sort of keep on top of it. But you asked me about admin. I've just spoken about saddle sores and bumps.
It's critical info. Yeah. Things that wouldn't really occur to anyone who's not been quite so long in the saddle. But you came onto an interesting point there as well, which I think to a lot of people, you know, you see the incredible photos, you're going through the mountains. Again, hilariously, you're like, "Yeah, well, anything that's like commercially available." I mean, it's not as if there's like Sainsbury's at every corner when you're in the middle of nowhere. So that must have been pretty limited. I was just imagining you carrying like tagines in your saddlebag. Don't travel very well.
It was the packaged cakes was ideal. But Trans-Balkan, there was kind of a point where I hit a resupply. And the only thing they'd sold was not packaged sandwiches, like sandwiches made to order. Okay. And I knew that it was a long, long stint until the next resupply. So, and I had nothing. So I was like, "Okay, I'm going to be living off sandwiches for a bit." And I just ordered 5 sandwiches, just assuming they'd be a sort of normal sized sandwiches. I could just put them in my bag. They came out sort of half an hour later with these five colossal sandwiches. You know, like
perfect.
Half a meter. But I, you know, could barely fit them in my back.
Down the jersey. Yeah, to the exact, bottom tube.
Literally, you know, strapped anywhere you could, and was just living. And to be fair, they were great. But you sort of have to take nutrition goes slightly out the window. You kind of take anything you can get. I suppose the other thing, like on the admin side of things, and you mentioned it before, is the sleep bit.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, how much do you sleep? How much can you skimp on sleep? When can you skimp on sleep? And that's really important, because if you are nodding off, which everyone will get to a point where they're cycling along and their head is like dropping. And if you get to that point and try and like battle through it for too long, it's hugely inefficient. And you're just going so slowly and it's dangerous. So kind of working out like what your limit is, if you get to that point, like, do you know how to kind of push through it? Like, or do you as an individual, like, do you need to stop as soon as you start feeling that? And the only way of like working that out is experience. Transbalkan, again, I went through a period where I got to a town in the evening, and the next bit was kind of not a high peak, but it was relatively high peak. So I was like, oh, I'm just going to push on and go for it. And I spent the next 4 hours hallucinating, head dropping. And I knew, you know, I knew there was a good place to sleep further on, and I just pushed on to it. And it was, like full on hallucinating. And that is, it's not a nice place to be. So, yeah, I kind of vowed not to get myself into that situation again. I came close to it at one point, but it wasn't as bad.
And when you say a nice place to sleep, are you looking for like local hostels? Are you sleeping under bushes? Like, what does that look like?
So I for this race, I slept one night in what you could describe as a hotel, probably close to a guest house, probably basic kind of room with something which resembled a bed. So I slept in one of those for one night, for about 2 hours, and then except for that I just slept out. So literally bivy, sleeping bag, little really lightweight kind of skeleton roll mat, which it's not that comfortable, but when you're that tired, it sort of does the trick. And literally just when you get to that point where you're nodding and you kind of try and make the decision that it's best for you to now stop and have a sleep, you literally just find a little spot which, you know, is shielded from the wind or whatever, and just sleep on the side of the trail, which is cool, you know. And it's you know, going back to that super basic kind of primitive state where it's just, you know, there's no frills. You're not looking for a town to go and sleep in. You are literally just like, right, it's time to sleep. I need to sleep now. Sleep. You do first couple of nights, you might not sleep that well, but beyond that, as soon as you get into your sleeping bag, you're out like a, you know, out cold.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
You alluded to it earlier when you mentioned that the bloke had to wrap himself in his down jacket. But the temperature difference, you're way up in the mountains during the night and during the day, must have been massive.
Yeah.
What sorts of kit did you have to take with you? And what did that kind of temperature change look like?
Yeah, so it was unseasonably cold. And the week before, a load of the kind of particularly like the front end riders were out there, you know, like just getting used to the terrain and doing some riding out there. And there were all these kind of Instagram stories of people riding through snow and people, you know, in full down jackets with like winter ski gloves on and like wrapping bags around their feet and things. And I think most people were thinking, oh god. And there's a Decathlon shop in Marrakesh, and you saw a lot of people being like, you know, like going to Decathlon to buy, you know, like ski kit, basically. So that was, you know, a new dimension. I thought I was, you know, coming from UK winter, I thought I was going to have to, and I genuinely was going to go and sort of sit in saunas a little bit in the 2 weeks building up to it to try and acclimatize. But it turns out that actually UK winter was perfect acclimatization. So yeah, I think you've got to think if it was like, what is, because you have, you know, like lots of different small bits of kit, like neck warmers and things like that. It's like, right, freezing cold, the coldest, what if I put all of my kit on, what does that look like? And I think for me, I had like winter socks, which, you know, I wasn't expecting that stuff, you know, two pairs of socks, shoe covers, a thermal base layer, like a really thin sort of cycling down jackety type thing, a proper down jacket, like a cycling, like skull cap, you know, head warmer thing, winter gloves, and then also thin gloves so I could put, you know, like two pairs of gloves on. And I was like, if that's not enough, then, you know, you probably need to get in a sleeping bag and, or, you know, find somewhere warm. So that just about kind of got me through. I don't think I would have bought anything else. In fact, I don't think I even used everything. But the first day, it starts at 6 o'clock at night, so it leaves Marrakesh at 6 o'clock, and it's sort of this big, it's kind of a neutralized zone for about an hour or so, and there's kind of police clearing the roads and things. It's pretty cool. And you're allowed to actually draft in that time, which any other time in the race you're not allowed to, and it's quite nice. And this the sort of peloton builds momentum, because it's like no one wants to fall off the back of this, because this is like the only time in the race where it's 3 miles, you just sit in the bunch and it's pretty easy going. But then once you're out of Marrakesh, it just slowly goes uphill, and it goes to the highest point of the race from Marrakesh, and it goes up to like 2,600 meters at night, and it's just snow-covered mountains. And, you know, it was quite sort of, it was a really strong moon on the first night, so you could see a lot, which was great. Well, possibly great, but you start sort of seeing yourself creeping towards the snow line, and it's quite kind of a dramatic scene, you know, the strong moon's shining on the mountain tops, which are just covered in snow, and you start getting higher and higher, and then it's just a whole load of pushing your bike uphill, and you get to the very top, and you're like, great, it's downhill, and it's a goat track, and it takes about, I can't actually remember because it's a bit of a blur, but I think it's about 2 hours to basically walk down this like really steep rocky trail. And some people at the front tried to ride it. I think there were sort of 3 crashes, and yeah, most people just walked it. But up the top there, I think people were saying it was clocking like minus 12 in places. So pretty cold. But then the worst, I think, as far as like just last bit on the cold, is between the hours of kind of 4 a.m. to 8 a.m., it was brutal. And there was a section of, which was quite nice in some respects, just flattish road, tarmac road for like 40 kilometers. And this was, for me, the coldest part of the race. It's like, it was quite mundane, quite boring, but because you're moving faster, because you're on the road, you get the wind chill, and the tarmac as well, it's actually much colder being on the tarmac than it is off road, like noticeably so. And that was the only time where I was just like, all right, I just need to just keep moving. Like another couple of hours of this, the sun's going to start coming out. But that was, you know, super cold. I remember going past someone and they were just on the side, like, I'm not sure what to do. Like, I'm absolutely freezing. Like, I can't really stop and get in my sleeping bag here. Like, there's nothing here. And I was just like, you literally just have to put on everything you've got and just move forward. But that was pretty cold. Yeah.
Unbelievable. What an incredible adventure. That was cool. Looking forward, what's next? Have you got anything? Have you got your eyes on anything?
I love these races because of the places they take you to. So I think it will be another one of these, but probably not a long one like the Atlas Mountains till next year. So in the meantime, I want to do a little bit of crit racing, which is obviously like a pretty different board game. I'm probably going to be pretty slow when I get back to it. And then possibly some kind of, they have like similar format races, but are more like 400K. So it's, you know, 36 hours as opposed to 5 days. And, you know, In the UK, so you don't have to take holiday, because I think I'm probably at my limit of dedicating my holidays to weird cycling events. So, I think it'll probably be that for now, and then next year another one of these epic things. That's probably the plan. There's something rumbling in the background with, you know, potentially at some stage upping the triple Ironman number, but we'll have to see.
Keep us posted. I'm not looking forward to the pre and the post interview there. It's been unbelievable. Thank you so much for making time to come and have a chat and sharing all your incredible adventures with us. Before we go, thinking ahead and thinking of other athletes who have also done unbelievable things, is there anyone you can think of, or anyone who comes to mind, who you'd like to hear their story on this podcast?
So I'm gonna keep it to the kind of bike pack racing theme.
Okay.
It's obviously quite a kind of a niche segment of sport. Within this sport, you know, this guy's Sofyan, and I've actually just forgotten his surname, but he is kind of at the very, very pointy end of this. He's, you know, won things like the Silk Road Mountain Race twice. He's won the Tour Divide, which is like a 3,500-kilometer version of what I've just did through America. He's phenomenal. And the reason I say him, so he was a courier in Paris, and he only turned to this when I think he was about 30. He's now early 40s, and he's still absolutely smashing it. But this guy doesn't need to sleep. Like, he's known to go like days without sleeping. What? And he just gets his phone out and like records himself, you know, posts Instagram stories of him like singing songs like to keep himself awake. And he just seems like an epic character. So if you can get this guy on, you absolutely should.
He's a
cool guy. Yeah, do. And then I suppose just the one other person, Lael Wilcox. So she is also like a pretty phenomenal bike pack racer.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, at the very pointy end of it as well. I think like her kind of whole ethos is about, you know, when we go back to like talking about enjoying these things and not taking it too seriously, that's all she's about. And even though she's at the very pointy end, like, I don't think she does anything unless she loves it. She's another really cool one to follow.
Amazing. We'll be definitely looking into both their stories. And on that note, thank you, Charlie. This has been great.
Harry, thank you so much. Cheers.